Captain Buford Jones felt dizzy at the higher altitude after their hard push across the flatland desert, but he felt satisfaction after the old Apache drum picked up the Renegade's trail.
Captain Jones, I don't like the look of them trees up yonder. They could be hiding in them pines waiting for us.
You worry too much, Sergeant Skinner. Those Apaches have gone deep into these miserable mountains. They'll play hide and seek with us, but there's nothing to worry about while we're down this low. It's when we get up to those mountaintops we'd best be vigilant.
That Mescalero could be leading us right where they want us. I sure as hell don't like the looks of them trees on both sides of this here trail.
If you're so damn worried about riding through that thicket, then you have my permission to find a way to ride around it.
Skinner fell silent, yet his full attention remained focused on the pinions, searching for anything that might be a hint of a bushwhacking in the making. Captain Jones's heart hammered when he saw Yase suddenly sit bolt upright in his saddle and rein his horse to an abrupt halt. Jones unsnapped the flap over his pistol and warily rode up next to the scout, accompanied by Skinner.
I say, why the hell are you stopping? Have you lost the trail?
The old scout didn't answer, just inclined his head. Buford followed his gaze. Three rotting, mutilated Apache corpses were hanging from the lower limb of a tree next to the trail. The feet were just inches from the ground, and the scavengers had eaten off the toes and lower part of the legs.
Jesus, God Almighty!
What do you make of this?
Evil spirits live in this forest. No white man would kill like this, and the people do not kill their own in this manner. Not ever.
Perhaps these were deserters and were killed by a Naiche to set an example.
No. When Apache kills Apache, it is done with respect. These bodies were desecrated.
Well, go on, keep following the track. We need to investigate further.
Yase cast a worried glance at Jones, but reluctantly heeled his horse forward. They rode into the trees without mishap, and Skinner seemed to be relieved. Buford hadn't given the order for his men to draw their rifles, simply because he did not share Skinner's concerns over an ambush at these lower altitudes. He relaxed the cantle of his cavalry saddle and took in a deep breath of pine-scented air, relieved to be climbing away from the horrible sight. Sergeant Skinner stood in his stirrups as Yase went tumbling limp to the ground, already dead. Sizzling balls of molten lead came flying from every direction. Behind Jones, many soldiers toppled to the earth, clutching mortal wounds. Jones knew what he had to do. He pulled his rifle, holding a tight grip on the reins to control his plunging sword.
Retreat!
From the corner of his eye, he saw Sergeant Skinner's left tunic sleeve erupt in a spray of blood and shreds of blue fabric. Skinner dropped his rifle to grab his wound, wheeling his horse down slope. Jones jerked the sorrel around. What he saw across the trail made him sick, his throat filling with bile. Dead and dying troopers lay everywhere. A bullet tore through Buford's cavalry hat, lifting it off his head as he was digging his spurs into the sorrel's sides. A burning sensation spread across his scalp just when his horse lunged into a headlong run. Suddenly, the surroundings turned an odd shade of red. He felt something wet dripping down his forehead, and he sleeved it away. Then he rubbed his eyes to clear him as his horse charged through the melee. Galloping past wounded men, he tasted fear on the tip of his tongue, wondering if he would get out of this alive. Sergeant Skinner, gripping his bleeding arm, galloped past him on a faster horse. He leaned over his chestnut's neck to make himself as small a target as possible, and after Jones saw that, he did likewise.
Retreat!
Jones galloped to the bottom of the trail behind Sergeant Skinner's mount. Together, along with seven surviving cavalrymen, they charged out onto the desert plain until their winded mounts forced them to slow to a trot, then a halt. Shooting at the mounts stopped. Jones looked back up the mountain slope. He could see bodies lying everywhere. Some wounded men were crawling towards safety.
Jesus.
I had a feeling they were in those goddamn trees.
Jones glanced up at the mountain trail again. Apaches began running from one fallen body to the next, scalping some of his men while they were still alive.
I sure as hell wish I'd listened to you, Skinner. Dear God, what kind of savages are these damn Indians?
They ain't human, Captain. The army should have killed every last one of them when they got them to Fort Thomas.
Yeah. Total extermination of this Apache race seems the only sensible solution. Let's head back to the fort. The colonel isn't gonna like what I have to say.
It was well past midnight when Buford led what remained of his company through the gates of Fort Thomas. Sergeant Skinner had lost so much blood he had to be held in the saddle, riding with a tight bandage around his shoulder to stem the blood flow.
Soldier, take Sergeant Skinner here to the post surgeon at once. I have to awaken Colonel Grant to give him my report.
Jones climbed Grant's porch steps, wondering if he would be stripped of his rank for having taken his men into a virtual slaughter. It was a clear demonstration of failure, an end to his dreams of promotion. The colonel's wife came to the door clad in a long cotton sleeping gown.
Yes?
Captain Buford Jones, ma'am. I'm sorry to awaken you so late, but I must speak to the colonel at once.
Please, come in, Captain. Take a chair and I'll wake my husband.
Thank you, ma'am.
Jones walked in, hat in hand, and sat in a rocking chair near a window. A lantern glowed softly on a small table. Within a minute, Grant appeared.
What is it, Captain? Why have you come to see me in the middle of the night, where you should be patrolling that region south of the massacre at Bisbee?
Buford rose with a salute.
Sir, we were ambushed, sir.
Ambushed? Where? Do we have casualties?
Very heavy casualties, I'm afraid, sir. We lost 24 men to a surprise attack as we entered the Dragoon Mountain Range. The old Mescalero picked up the trail of the raiding party, and we followed it to the western edge of the mountains. The Dragoons are at least 60 miles long. We expected to meet armed resistance once we entered the higher regions, but they laid a trap for us at a wooded spot just as we were beginning our climb.
Did I hear you correctly, Captain? 24 troops of Company D are dead?
Yes, sir. They shot the old Apache first. They were well hidden on both sides of the trail in a dense pine forest. There was absolutely no warning.
The Mescalero. Yase, was he drunk?
No, sir. I kept his bottles of whiskey in my saddlebags to prevent that. I told him he could only drink after we camped for the night.
And your Indian scout was still unaware of the renegade's presence before the ambush?
Well, he was the first man killed when the shooting started. 9 of us made it out alive. Sergeant Skinner has a deep wound in his shoulder. He's at the surgeon's quarters now for medical attention. I narrowly avoided death myself, sir. Had the bullet been only an inch or two lower, I'd be lying dead on that trail.
What is your estimate of the number of renegades who attacked you?
At least 50, sir. We were badly outnumbered, quite possibly more.
50. Our roll call of the Apaches held prisoner here showed only 30 men missing. This could mean Geronimo has joined forces with the Chiricahua chief. Or it may well be that some of Naiche's renegades are escapees from San Carlos. I'll wire the Indian agent this morning. If Naiche has 50 armed Indians under his leadership, armed with our own repeating rifles, I'll be forced to send for reinforcements.
I would strongly recommend that, sir. There may have been far more than 50 Apaches shooting at us. It was hard to make an accurate count.
Let us pray the other companies we have searching for these runaways have fared better than you did. This calls for a new tactic. I must combine what forces we have into a single unit.
I wholeheartedly agree, sir. We could put roughly 150 cavalrymen afield, leaving a small force to keep a sufficient guard on the Apaches here at the reservation. With 150 armed cavalry, we can strike Chief Naiche with overwhelming superiority.
Yes. This calls for a sound strategy and superior numbers. I was unaware they had grown so strong. Get some rest, Captain. I'll send messengers out to collect the other companies we have in the field, and preparations will be made to launch a major offensive. All these Indian attacks, the tremendous death toll, and the way those Indians carve up their victims will make newspaper headlines across the country. And when my report reaches Washington, it'll sound as if I've been able to put down a major insurrection. There'll be a hue and cry from all quarters to have me transferred. Or demoted.
Jones allowed himself to relax. The colonel wasn't blaming him for what had happened. He stood up abruptly and moved toward the door.
Good night, Colonel.
Yes, good night, Captain Jones.
A small white lie had salvaged the career of Buford Jones. a lie no one could dispute, since it was impossible to judge how many Indians had set upon him. His surviving troopers, even Sergeant Skinner, would not dispute his estimate. He headed for the surgeon's quarters to see if he needed stitches where his hair had been parted by a bullet. Cuchillo held up his hand, stopping the 12 riders behind him. He looked left and right at the heavy forest of pine trees on either side of the trail.
Here is a good place for our ambush. The White Eyes who killed our brothers will be coming this way soon.
One of the braves led the ponies off deeper into the forest. Then Cuchillo and his band settled in to await the coming of their prey. Behind Cuchillo and his men, lying flat on their stomachs upslope of the trail, Hawk and Falcon watched the ambush being set through their binoculars.
How many did you count?
I got about 12 or 13, give or take one or two.
Agreed. Should we take them out now or wait and do it later?
No time like the present.
A man after my own heart. What do you think about Cal and Jasper? You think they'll be able to hold their own?
Yeah, if the situation's right. I know Jasper's had plenty of experience, but Franklin's another matter entirely. I expect he'll be all right if the advantage is ours and he don't have to do no thinking.
Falcon nodded and they turned to crawl back up the ridge toward where they'd left Cal and Jasper. Once they got there, Falcon gathered the three men around him as he outlined their plan of attack.
The Apache are spread out, six men on either side of the trail. Their attention is back toward the east, where they think we'll be coming from. Jasper, I want you and Cal to stay upslope and have some dynamite ready. Hawk and I'll go in silently and take out as many as we can with knives. When they realize what we're doing, I want you two to drop a couple of sticks on them.
What about you and Hawk? Won't you be in danger from the dynamite, too?
No. Throw the dynamite as close to the trail as you can. Hawk and I will stay well back from the path. And as soon as we hear any commotion, we'll hit the dirt and get behind something. Any questions?
Yeah. Why do you and Hawk get all the fun? I'm getting kind of tired of always being on the outside during a tumble.
Your history in combat don't exactly inspire confidence, Meeks. Last time you had a chance at some fun, as you call it, you turned tail and ran.
Well, you son of a bitch!
Settle down, Jasper. It's just that I know Hawk can kill without making any noise. Believe me, you'll get your chance to kill some Indians.
10 minutes later, Falcon was crawling on his hands and knees toward the ambushers. He slipped his Arkansas toothpick from its scabbard and slipped silently around the trunk of a tree. He threw his left arm around a brave's neck and plunged the knife into the middle of his back, severing the spinal cord and shutting down his brain so fast he didn't even have time to make a sound. He lowered the body gently to the carpet of pine needles on the ground, then crept through the brush toward the next Indian. Two down. Falcon moved silently toward his third kill. The scream came from the other side of the trail. One of Hawk's victims had managed to cry out. Falcon was still 5 feet from his intended victim when the brave turned at the sound nearby. His face blanched in surprise as he raised his rifle at Falcon. Falcon threw his knife as hard as he could, then dove to the side. The Arkansas toothpick embedded itself in the breastbone of the Indian, knocking him backward and throwing off his aim just enough to miss Falcon. Though the wound was painful, it wasn't a kill, and the brave levered the Winchester to try and get off another round. Falcon hit the dirt and rolled once, coming up on his knees, hands filled with iron. He put the bullet in the brave's forehead, snapping his head back and flinging him backward. Falcon whirled around in time to see an Apache running at him with a knife in hand. Falcon had no time to aim his pistol and barely got his hands up in time to block the knife thrust. The two men collided chest to chest and went backwards over the rocks. Each went for the other's throat as they rolled around on the ground. Falcon had his left hand on the Indian's wrist holding the knife, while his right hand was trying to get a grip on the brave's throat. After two rolls, the Indian ended up on top and slowly pushed the knife down towards Falcon's face. Suddenly, the savage's head seemed to explode, completely disappearing above the eyes, showering Falcon with blood and brains. He rolled and threw the Indian's dead body off him and saw Jasper Meeks standing 20 feet away, smoke curling from the barrel of his Winchester.
Oh, thanks, Jasper.
Think nothing of it, Falcon. All in a day's work.
Have we got all of them?
Yep. 12 are dead and one's wounded pretty bad.
Take me to them.
Meeks walked back toward the trail and stopped next to a body lying on its back, arms flung out, eyes closed. Falcon nodded, a slow smile curving his lips.
We're in luck, Jasper. That's the leader of this little party. The one we let get away to carry the message to Naiche that we were after him.
If you say so, Chief, they all look the same to me.
Falcon pulled his bandana from around his neck and wrapped it tightly around the bullet crease on Cuchillo's skull, stopping the bleeding.
I won't keep this one alive if we can. He'll have some mighty interesting things to say to Naiche when they find him.
Hawk and Cal Franken walked out of the bushes, Hawk holding 3 scalps in his hand.
You want we should dress what's left of the rest of them up like we did the others, Falcon?
Absolutely. It's time we sent Naiche another message. I want him to be convinced that the Hounds of Hell are on his trail and won't give up until he's dead. If we can keep him thinking about us, maybe he'll pay less attention to raiding the countryside.
That's right. A man who's worried overly much about his back trail don't always keep his eye on what's up ahead of him.
Naiche was worried. He had heard the gunfire in the distance, coming from the direction he'd sent Cuchillo. He wondered briefly if perhaps Cuchillo might have run into a squad of soldiers, for he couldn't make himself believe for a moment that 4 whites could give Cuchillo and his 12 braves much of a battle. He caught Chicole's eyes and inclined his head toward a spot near a juniper tree where they wouldn't be seen by the others milling around the fires.
Chicole, I fear Cuchillo may have failed us. I want you to take Ja and follow Cuchillo's trail. Find out what has happened. I do not want the young ones to know of this.
Chicole reached out her hand and lightly touched Naiche's shoulder.
Perhaps you are mistaken in your feelings, Chief Naiche. It may be that Cuchillo is merely late in returning and has successfully killed the intruders.
I hope you are right, Chicole. But if there are such men on our trail, then plans will have to be made to remove them. I will be unable to send out any more raiding parties until this matter is taken care of.
Naiche's head jerked around at the signal for extreme danger. He turned from Chicole and sprinted to his wickiup, grabbing his Winchester rifle and levering a shell into the chamber as he turned toward the sound. A young brave ran down the path from the sentry post as fast as he could, looking back over his shoulder as if the devil himself were after him. Naiche walked rapidly to intercept the brave, having to reach out and grab his arm as he tried to run past.
Kumo, what is the matter?
Up there. Haba has been killed.
Our sentry has been killed, and you left your post unattended!
Naiche backhanded the young brave.
I will see to your punishment later, Kumo.
Warriors, arm yourselves! To the lookout!
When they arrived at the spot, Naiche posted 2 warriors to keep watch for intruders and walked to the boulder where the sentry was stationed. His stomach lurched at the sight awaiting him. The young brave known as Jabba's head had been cut off, and he was holding it under his arm. The freshly scalped skull gleamed in the weak moonlight. Jabba's empty eye sockets were staring at Naiche. Juh stepped to the side of the body and knelt down, examining it closely. After a moment, he stood up.
Jabba's Winchester and ammunition pouch are missing, as is his knife.
Naiche grabbed Juh by the arm and pulled him aside.
Take Chicole and find Cuchillo. Do not let the others see you leave. No questions. Go.
A little over 2 hours later, Chicole and Jub were riding to the east. Jub bent over his pony's back as he followed the small signs of Cuchillo's passing. Chicole reined her pony to a halt. Jub looked up, feeling the hair on the back of his neck stir at what he saw. Hanging spread-eagled in the middle of the trail was Cuchillo. His head flopped forward, blood slowly dripping from a wound on his clean-shaven head. Jud looked at Chicole and saw for the first time what he took to be fear in her eyes. They both levered rounds into their Winchesters as they watched the bushes on either side for signs of an ambush.
He still lives.
Chicole slipped to the ground and walked up to Cachillo. Slipping her knife from its scabbard, she cut the ropes holding him up and caught him in her arms as he fell forward, gently laying him on the ground. Judd dismounted and knelt next to Cachillo as Chicole shook him awake. As Cachillo's eyes opened, he tried to get to his feet, a terrified expression on his face. Chicole grabbed his shoulder, pressing hard into the flesh with her fingers to get his attention.
Cuchillo, what happened here?
They came. There was no warning.
They attacked you while you were riding after them?
No. We were hidden on the other side of trail waiting in ambush for them to ride into our trap when suddenly...
You and the other warriors heard nothing of their approach?
No one could get that close without making a sound.
What are you saying?
Cuchillo grabbed Jub by the arm.
These men are demons. They appear without warning and kill without mercy, and then disappear as if they were never there.
Jub gently took Cuchillo's hand from his arm and stood up.
I go to find the rest of the warriors with Cuchillo.
See if you can find a pony for Cuchillo to ride back to camp. I will get him up on his feet.
20 yards up the trail, Jub smelled blood and death nearby. He stepped into the brush next to the path, eyes wide. All of Cuchillo's warriors were lined up on the ground, arms outstretched and their fingers touching, as if holding hands. Their eyes and scalps had been removed, and their throats had been cut. Several sets of body parts were arranged nearby. Judd shook his head as he looked at what was left of his friends. He didn't believe for a minute what Cuchillo said about these white men being monsters. But he knew one thing Cuchillo was right about. They fought like demons. Meanwhile, Falcon and his small band lay on their stomachs in heavy brush, less than 100 yards from the cross where the female Apache and the Brave found Cuchillo. Falcon propped his elbows on the ground and watched them through his binoculars. Though he couldn't hear what they were saying, he could read body language well enough to know they were shaken by what they'd found. The woman warrior kept looking over his shoulder, searching for imaginary enemies about to come out of the dark. Falcon's plan was working. The usually imperturbable Apache were realizing that there were forces that could defeat them as easily as they were accustomed to defeating the whites. It was just what he wanted them to think. After the Brave managed to find and catch one of the ponies belonging to the war party, he and the woman helped the wounded Indian up on the animal. They slowly rode off back down the trail, continuously looking over their shoulders. Soon, they were out of sight.
I never would have believed it was possible, Falcon. I never thought I'd see the day Apaches were spooked.
It's a good idea you had, Falcon. Killing them Injuns in the same way they kill whites seems to have stuck in their craw.
That's the plan, Hawk. Throw something they're not used to at them and see how they react.
Well, it may be working like you said, and it may be causing the Indians some trouble, but I still don't like it. It just ain't Christian, doing what we've done to them bodies. They may be Indians, but that don't mean we should cut them up like they was cattle.
Maybe you just don't have a stomach for what we got going on, Franklin.
Franklin turned his head to stare into Hawk's face, not giving an inch.
I got as much stake in this as you do, Hawkins. They killed my friends and partners, and I came along for vengeance.
What difference do it make what happens to your body after you're dead and gone? It's not like we was torturing those Braves while they were still alive.
Anytime it gets too rough out here for you, feel free to hightail it on back to your mine, Franklin. We can get along just fine without you.
Hold on. We need every gun we have, Hawk. And every man has a right to his own beliefs and feelings. If Cal doesn't feel right about the way we've been treating the dead Indians, he doesn't have to help with that part of it.
If and you say so, Falcon.
Cal, you have to realize why we're doing this. Cutting up those dead men has confused the Apache. If they're confused and worried about us, they don't have time to go running around the country killing other people like they did your friends. It bothers all of us, Cal. None of us likes doing this sort of thing, but we're in a war here.
I expect so.
What's next, Falcon?
I'm going to trail those three back to the Apache camp. I want to make sure Naiche doesn't move his camp before we can get some help up here to clean them out.
And what about us?
I'd like you to head on back to Tombstone and send a telegraph to Fort Thomas. We need to let the army know we found Naiche.
And why can't Meeks and Franklin go to Tombstone and me come with you?
It's gonna be hard enough for one person to watch the camp without being seen. After this, they'll have double the lookouts. There's just no way two of us, no matter how careful, could escape being caught.
Well, all right. But that don't mean I got to like it.
I figure it'll take the army 2 or 3 days to get a sizable force here from the fort. Try to get them to agree to meet me here, at this location early in the morning of the 3rd day from now. And I'll let them know what the situation is at the camp.
Them army commanders are stubborn. What if they don't agree to wait for you to get there and want to head on in on their own?
Simple. Don't tell them where the camp is. Just tell them you'll bring them here, and I'll lead them the rest of the way.
They won't like it.
They don't have to. Just tell them it's my way, or they can stumble around in these mountains for the next year trying to find the camp on their own, while Naiche goes on killing people.
As the others got their horses ready for the journey back to Tombstone, Falcon worked on his rig. He tightened all parts of the saddle and rein so there would be no rattle or stray sounds. Just before getting on Diablo, he took a small tin of boot black from his saddlebag and rubbed it on his face. Though the moon wasn't full, there was still plenty of light to reflect off his pale skin. After that, he removed his buckskins and replaced them with the black shirt and pants. He moved down the trail as silent as a ghost. By the time he was 15 yards away from his friends, he was completely invisible. It didn't take Falcon long to catch up with the 3 Indians heading back to their base camp. He stayed well behind them. After a few minutes, Falcon came to a spot he remembered. There was a tiny creek that flowed just behind a huge upthrust of rock. If his memory served him correctly, he knew the place reasonably well. He quickly swung in behind the rocks and ran back to deliberately cover his trail as clumsily as possible. Then, staying on rocky ground, Falcon got his rifle and ran to a smaller outcrop in the rocks about 40 feet away and directly across from the rocks that lay in front of the creek. He made himself as comfortable as possible and waited. The Indians had come to the edge of the camp and were signaling a sentry. Falcon walked Diablo up the side of the mountain slope into heavy brush until they were 100 yards off the path the sentry was watching. He tied the animal next to a pine just below a distinctive outcropping of the ledge above him on the mountainside. He wanted to be sure to be able to find his mount if he had to leave in a hurry. He knew the odds of his getting to the camp, doing what he had to do, and escaping with his hair still attached were less than 50-50. Falcon started his long walk up the mountain. He'd left the horse a good ways away from the Indian camp so the animal wouldn't be tempted to nicker call to the Indian ponies that were in the valley up above. Luckily, the moon was at 3/4, and there were a few scurrying clouds in the winter sky. The moonlight was bright enough for Falcon to see where he was going, and to avoid stepping on twigs or sticks and alerting the Indians to his presence. And the clouds provided occasional periods of almost total darkness so that he would be able to move freely. Falcon smelled the campsite long before he saw it. The pungent odor of roasting mule tickled his nose and made his stomach growl. He patted his abdomen and then rubbed it vigorously to try and make it settle down.
It'd be a hell of a note if you lose your scalp because your stomach's talking.
The stifled cough from up ahead reminded Falcon he was not alone on the mountain. He stood motionless, scarcely breathing. After a moment, he picked out a shadow next to a juniper bush, slightly darker than the surrounding leaves and branches. He stared past it, letting the image fall on the corner of his eye. Moving slowly, an inch at a time, being very careful not to let his body be outlined against any moonlit areas, Falcon backed up until he could no longer see the sentry. Once out of sight, he turned to the right and made a wide circle around the lookout, knowing that since he'd already killed one of the warriors who'd been standing guard, Naiche would likely have increased the number of men guarding the camp. He moved through the night like a wraith, blade in his hand, his other fist doubled and ready to strike if necessary. After another hour of painstakingly slow progress, Falcon came to an overhang where he could crawl to the edge and have an unobstructed view of the Indian camp below. He counted 5 fires scattered around the small area, arranged on both sides of the small stream running through the middle of the canyon. Squaws were roasting large chunks of meat over the flames, while some tin and pottery bowls were placed over the coals at the edge of the fires to heat beans and stews. He looked for the largest wickiup, hoping to find Naiche among the warriors walking around the camp. Sure enough, off to the right, he saw the three he'd been tailing sitting talking to the man he thought was Naiche. The woman seemed to have Naiche's ear. He thought it strange for a female to be so trusted by the leader of the renegades, for he knew that women in the Apache tribes generally ranked little higher than dogs. Even so, here was one who carried a Winchester and sat and spoke with the leader as an equal. Soon the meeting was over, and Naiche waved the three away and retired to his wickiup, presumably to go to sleep. Falcon tried to make a count of the number of warriors milling around the fires, and soon gave up. The Indians moved around too much to make an accurate count, and at this distance in the semi-darkness, he couldn't even be sure if some of the figures were male or female. Falcon settled in to wait for the camp to get quiet as the rest of the Apaches began to head for their wickiups and sleep. It was an hour later when Falcon was startled out of a semi-doze by a sound nearby. He slowly rolled onto his side, searching the ground in the darkness for his knife, which he had evidently dropped in his sleep. He released the breath he'd been holding when his fingers closed around the handle of the toothpick. Now, even if he were discovered, he had a fighting chance to defend himself. Falcon held his breath and slitted his eyes to hide their whites as a young man strolled into view, holding hands with a pretty young female of a similar age. Falcon knew he was practically invisible, lying on the dark humus of the rocky floor with his face and hands blackened and his dark clothes. But the couple was walking directly toward him. It seemed no matter how quickly he moved, one or the other would be able to sound an alarm before he could silence them both. Suddenly, the man stopped and took the girl by the shoulders, turning her face to him. He gently placed his lips against hers. After a moment, they broke apart. Then the girl turned and ran off back the way they'd come. The young warrior shook his head before turning and following her. Falcon grinned to himself. He'd heard of a few men being shot, and even one who was hanged for stealing a kiss. But this was the first time he'd seen it save a man's life. He slipped the knife back into its scabbard and rolled back over to take a look at the camp. The fires had almost burned themselves out, and there was no movement at all among the wickiups. Since it was obvious there was going to be no mass exodus from the area tonight, Falcon decided it was time for him to seek a more secure hiding place until the next morning. He crawled back from the edge of the precipice and then got to his feet and slipped off into the night. After a while, he found a shallow cave. Falcon gathered some nearby brush and pulled it over the entrance, then crawled to the rear of the small enclosure and lay down. He needed to get some sleep. Tired men make mistakes, and tomorrow he was going to need to be at his best to do what he planned to do. Falcon awoke just as dawn was breaking over the eastern peaks of the Dragoons. The cave was so cold he had to brush ice off his nose and eyebrows. He crawled to the entrance and peered out. Once he was sure no one was about, he climbed carefully out into feeble sunlight and slowly rose to his feet. He stretched and did some slow exercises to get the kinks out of muscles grown stiff and sore from lying on the cold, damp earth of the hole in the ground. His mouth watered as he smelled the aroma of breakfast cooking on open fires in the Indians' camp. He ran a dry tongue over gritty teeth, wishing he had thought to bring his canteen from Diablo's saddle. He used a fallen branch to brush away his footprints near the cave entrance. No need to let the Indians know anyone was there, since he might well have to make use of it again. As quietly as he could, Falcon threaded his way through the dense undergrowth to the precipice and peeked over the edge. Down below, he saw a couple of older men and Naiche climb on the back of three ponies being held by a younger warrior. Naiche appeared to be giving some orders to several men waiting nearby.
Evidently, they're going on a scouting party. Since there aren't enough of them for a war party,
Since Naiche obviously wasn't going to be moving the base camp anytime soon, Falcon decided to head back down the trail toward Tombstone to see if Hawk and the others had made any progress in alerting the army. Slowly, so as to not make any unnecessary noise, Falcon made his way back up the slope of the hillside toward where he'd left Diablo reined to a tree. He had no trouble picking out the tall pinyon or the distinctive outcropping of the mountain, and he found his mount without any trouble. After drinking his fill from his canteen, he stepped into the stirrups and spurred the horse down the mountain toward Tombstone, glancing back over his shoulder occasionally to make sure no warriors were on his trail. Lying flat against a slab of stone, Naiche and Nana saw the soldiers climbing a steep, winding trail into the dragoons. The 50 or 60 soldiers didn't concern him as much as the scout who rode out in front of him, his face to the ground, a face all but obscured by twin braids of shoulder-length orange-red curly hair.
They have a scout now. He reads our tracks carefully, too carefully, like an Apache, only his hair is the wrong color.
I've heard of him, I think. His hair is red and long like an Apache. Only he is not one of us. He is called Mickey Free. He is half white. The White Eyes call him the Apache Hunter. Cochise told us about him. One of the last times our great leader talked to Geronimo. I was there. Mickey Free is from this land. He was a boy when a band of Mimbres captured him and stole the livestock where he was working for a white man. For 10 winters, Free lived as an Apache with the Mimbres and the Mescaleros, kept as a slave. While he was with our people, he learned to track animals and men, to hunt deer and buffalo, and to steal horses from the Arapaho. After 10 winters, he escaped to live with the whites. He became a scout for the Bluecoats. He led the soldiers to the big battle at a place called Dry Gulch, where so many of our people were killed. It is said he has the eyes of an eagle, and he hates all Apaches for the way he was treated when he was our prisoner.
He misses nothing.
The scout stopped for a moment. Without coming down from his horse, he led the soldiers onto the left fork, the direction Cachillo and his warriors had taken.
You see, he sees the prints of our ponies on solid rock.
Jud lifted his rifle to his shoulder.
We must kill him.
The range is too far. We must be sure of the bullet that takes his life.
Naiche saw Mickey Free stop his pinto, then look directly up at their hiding place.
He knows we are watching him. He is not afraid.
He will lead the Bluecoats to our village. We must find a way to kill him before he does.
All men die when a bullet strikes the right place. Let me get in front of him, and I will kill him.
We wait until Free comes to the right place.
He knows we are here. See how he looks up at the mountain? The spirits are guiding his eyes to us.
Before Naiche could answer, Free halted the soldiers again and pointed up at the mountain where Naiche and the others were in hiding.
What will we do? How can we lay a trap for the soldiers if Free is telling them where we are?
We're surrounded by enemies. The other White Eyes are approaching, and we can find no way to stop him or surprise him with an attack. Now this man with long red hair comes, bringing many soldiers, and he seems to know where we are.
We must move our camp again very soon.
Yes, but before we do, we will kill the 4 whites who cut out the eyes of our warriors.
We must find them first. Some of our best trackers have been unable to pick up their sign.
Nana's and Juz's doubts would spread like a sickness through his younger warriors unless Naiche did something to stop it, and it had to be done soon.
We ride back to the camp and pick the best fighters among us. Then we will look for the 4 White Eyes, while the women and young warriors take down our camp. We will move south, closer to the big river in Mexico.
Why do we go south? There the mountains have no trees, and water is scarce.
Cochise told me the Bluecoats cannot cross the river into Mexico. Their strange laws make a river into a wall. If the soldiers come close, we will escape to Mexico and look for the camp of Geronimo.
Naiche inched backward on the stone slab, signaling for the others to do the same. Down below, Mickey Free was talking to the leader of the Bluecoats. For now, the soldiers were not moving at all. Naiche hurried to his horse, and using a fistful of mane, he swung over the bay's back.
Come. Be careful where you leave the print of a horse on our return to camp. Free will come here to look for our tracks.
Riding from rock slab to gravel beds and low dry washes, Naiche led his men away from the soldier columns and the Apache hunter. His spirit taunted him while they rode off, for it whispered that a brave war chief would not run and hide from someone like Mickey Free or the four White Eyes who were coming into the Dragoons. This called for an all-out attack on the four whites to rid Naiche and his band of their trickery. Only then could they make plans to ambush the soldiers and kill the red-haired scout who led them.
Can this Mickey Free have learned all our battle secrets in 10 winters? No, it is not possible. I will prove it.
Naiche's mind was full of plans. First, he would get his women and children safe by moving the camp south. Then he would have to do something about the four White Eyes. Then there was the problem of what was to be done with Cuchillo. His repeated failures had made Naiche's leadership seem bad. The Indian leader shook his head to clear it of the ideas buzzing inside. Battle to the death was far easier than the responsibility of being chief. Knowing there were no war parties in the vicinity allowed Falcon to keep Diablo on the trail, and he was making good time until the big stud raised his head and pointed his ears forward. Falcon knew this meant Diablo had either heard or smelled something up ahead, so he quickly jerked the horse's head to the left and ran him up into heavy brush just off the trail. He pulled his Winchester out of its saddle boot and waited. Before long, three riders came into view. Though they were being careful and keeping the noise to a minimum, they didn't manage to spot Falcon in his hiding place.
Damn good thing I'm not one of Naiche's braves.
For a moment, he considered bursting out of hiding and scaring the bejesus out of the three men. He decided against it, for they might go off half-cocked and fire a weapon, warning Naiche someone was on the mountain near his campsite. Falcon walked Diablo out into the open just as Hawk and the others came abreast of his position. He slid the Winchester back into the saddle boot.
Howdy, boys.
Shit!
Other than a quick jerk of his head as Falcon called out his greeting, Hawk managed to hide his surprise at Falcon's sudden appearance in the bushes next to the trail. Meeks wasn't quite so calm, and he managed to get his pistol half out of its holster before he recognized Falcon. Franklin's response worried Falcon the most. The miner didn't move and barely looked up. The man appeared to Falcon to be almost despondent, as if he had something heavy on his mind. Falcon cut his eyes at Franklin and raised a questioning eyebrow to Hawk. The big man shrugged while making a disdainful face. He'd made it clear from the start that he had very little respect for either Franklin or Meeks.
You men have any trouble in Tombstone?
None to speak of. We sent a wire to Fort Thomas requesting to speak with Colonel Grant or whoever was in charge of fighting the renegades.
The colonel was busy at some social shindig, sucking up to bigwigs from Washington, probably, and the men out doing the dirty work of chasing Indians wasn't in the fort right then. We left a message for any real soldiers who wanted a chance to kill some Redskins to meet us at noon tomorrow or the next day, just below Indian Head Peak. Said we'd be waiting for them.
Franklin, you look like a man with something stuck in his craw. Why don't you just spit it out and we'll all feel better?
I don't think I can take any more of this, boys.
Any more of what?
This butchering the Indians after they're dead. I've killed enough to last me a while. I'm done with riding the Vengeance Trail, boys. I'm going to light on back toward Tombstone.
What do you do then, Cal?
Falcon knew some of what Cal was going through, what any civilized man would go through doing what they'd done. He knew that if his Marie hadn't been butchered by renegade Apaches in the past, he would have had a hard time acting this way too. Franklin shrugged, looking back over his shoulder toward Tombstone.
Well, first, I plan to sell some of my dust and drink until I don't see those Injuns' faces in my sleep no more. Then I'll probably mosey on back to my claim and do a little more mining.
Cal, you'd be wise to hold up in Tombstone until this Indian uprising is over. Those renegades have hit your place once. Nothing says they won't hit it again if you go back there.
We'll see. I don't have no firm plans just yet. I only know I gotta get away from all this killing.
Falcon nudged Diablo forward until he was next to Franklin. He held out his hand.
Good luck to you then, partner.
Thanks, Falcon. You watch your scalp, you hear?
He nodded at Hawks and Meeks, then turned his mount and put him in a slow lope toward town.
Damn coward.
Hell, he ain't no coward. He's a smart one of the bunch.
How about we make camp? I haven't eaten anything since yesterday. I'm in strong need of some coffee. Now, just where is this Indian Head Peak where we're supposed to meet the army tomorrow?
Later that afternoon, Falcon left Hawk and Jasper Meeks at their camp and traveled back to where the Indians had their base camp. He wanted to see if Naiche had returned and to see if any war parties were being formed. He got to the precipice overlooking the camp just as the last Wikiup was being dismantled and found the women and children and warriors packed up and ready to move. As the caravan of Indians pulled out of the valley and took a trail leading toward the southern edge of the Dragoons, where mountain slopes descended into a flat desert, Falcon followed at a discreet distance. He hoped Meeks and Hawk would have sense enough to wait for him at Indian Head Peak, along with the army. As soon as he found out where the Indians' new camp was going to be, he'd hightail it back to the meeting place. The Indians, with Naiche in the lead, slowly wound their way south through the mountains, the trail descending toward the desert the farther south they traveled.
If they keep going like this, they're going to be on the desert floor before long.
Just before the path turned and ran straight down to the desert floor, Naiche turned his people off and led them into a small box canyon that couldn't be seen from more than 100 yards away. The Indians at the rear of the group covered the entrance to the canyon with deadfall branches and tree limbs after the rest of the people had entered.
Damn. If I hadn't seen them go in there, I'd never find the entrance to that canyon. No wonder they've managed to elude the army so easily. They can just disappear into these mountains.
He looked around and made a mental note marking the surrounding terrain so he could lead the army back to this spot, if they showed up as scheduled. Before leaving, Falcon climbed to a ridge overlooking the valley below to take a last look. What he saw made him uneasy. The Indians were not erecting their wikiups, but were making what looked like a temporary camp. Wood was being gathered and cooking fires were being lighted, but there was no semi-permanent structures being put up. It looked to Falcon as if the Indians didn't plan to be here very long, possibly not even long enough for him to go and get the army and bring the soldiers back. Now what? He had to decide whether to take a chance and go to Indian Head Peak and fetch the army, or to hang around here for a while longer to see just what Naiche's plans were. Falcon knew that if the Indians moved again without him following, they would once again disappear into the Dragoons. He pondered his choices as he sat and watched the Indian women cooking on their fires. Dawn came slowly to the Apaches' camp, hidden in a pocket canyon, where a tiny pool offered rare water in the southernmost part of the Dragoons, the driest section of this mountain range, where wild game and grass were as scarce as water. The canyon where they camped now was aptly named Wild Pig Springs, since only the desert-dwelling javelina could find enough forage here to survive. Retreating south from their Deer Springs hideout, Naiche and his followers would soon be forced to cross dangerous open desert flats to be able to reach the Pedregosa Mountains that would take them to Mexico and the high Sierra Madres, where Geronimo was said to be in hiding, raiding Mexican rancheros. Cuchillo lay on a moth-eaten army blanket, groaning, his head still bleeding, as was a deep gash in his right side. Naiche sat cross-legged beside him, asking questions. Chicole and Juh listened in silence. The women and warriors who were not stationed in the surrounding mountains as lookouts prepared the camp gear and livestock to move again on a moment's notice. Some of the women filled water skins to tie to the backs of stolen cavalry horses for what Naiche promised would be a very difficult journey across the desert to reach the mountains in Mexico.
Cuchillo, these white men, There are two who wear deer skins like the clothing worn by northern Indian tribes?
Yes. One is very tall, big. He moves like mountain cat. I saw and heard nothing when he moved among the rocks. He kills with a knife, the longest knife I have ever seen, and the blade makes no noise. He kills our best warriors, and no one hears a sound or sees a shadow.
Naiche thought of a solution to the unrest among the people, for signs of fear were everywhere on the faces of his followers. It would be better to put the blame for Cachillo's failure on Cachillo himself, calling him a coward, a man unfit to call himself an Apache. While this was not true, for Cachillo was a born fighter with skills equal to any warrior in the camp, he were made to look foolish for costing the lives of the warriors he led to halt the four white-skinned invaders, people would have less fear of an approaching enemy.
Come to me, all my people.
Across the narrow canyon, warriors and women halted their preparations to walk toward Naiche and the place where Cachillo lay on the blood-soaked army blanket. Naiche waited for the others to arrive. 30 warriors and women gathered around Naiche, and by the look on their faces, they expected some additional bit of grave news. Most had been shocked when they learned what had happened to Cachillo and his war party.
Hear me! My heart is heavy to say these words, but I must tell you why we are leaving this ancient place of refuge used by our forefathers. It is no longer safe here, and one of our own, an Apache brother, is at fault. He has given the white enemy a chance to kill us. I speak of a man we all believe was filled with courage. Cachillo took his warriors into a trap. Their lives were his responsibility as leader of the war party.
No! No, we covered our tracks. We hid ourselves among the rocks very, very carefully.
Naiche reached for a cavalryman's pistol tucked into his belt.
All the others are dead except you, Cachillo. No Apache would allow this to happen to his brothers.
No! No, we covered our tracks. We hid among the rocks and brush as we were taught.
Do not kill him. We need every warrior who can fight these white demons.
It is not enough, Chakole. The lives of our best fighting men must be spared from a poor leader who forgets the ways of the Apache. When a war leader costs the people the lives of his men, he must die.
Chakole backed away to stand beside Judd. She realized the futility of trying to change Naiche's mind. She was a warrior, but she was still a woman, and had to mind her place when their chief spoke. Naiche knew he had his audience convinced of Cachillo's incompetence.
I send our brother, Cachillo, to join his ancestors. May his spirit walk the dark places filled with sorrow for what he has done.
No!
In his hiding place, overlooking Wild Pig Springs Canyon, Falcon sucked in his breath at the sight of Cachillo's cold-blooded execution. In all of his travels, he had never once heard of an Apache killing a brother warrior. Naiche must be extremely worried to take such a drastic step. In single file, the Apaches left Wild Pig Springs, leading horses and mules laden with supplies for the arduous journey across the desert. At the front of the procession, Naiche rode one of the fresh cavalry horses. Joe rode beside him on one flank. Chakole kept her horse in check on the other flank, watching the mountains and passes for signs of the enemy.
The people are afraid now, Naiche.
Naiche knew Joe was right, and he understood their fear. For the first time in his life, he also feared an enemy. But as chief of the Chiricahua band, he could not allow his fear to show.
Chakole says it was wrong to kill Cachillo. He fought the White Eyes with courage.
He led his men towards death. He was foolish, Ja.
These men who come, I have a bad feeling about them. I had a dream, a vision. In my dream, These whites were from another place where men do not die in battle.
These are the dreams of children. All men die when a bullet or arrow finds its mark. Stop talking like a woman, Ja. You have seen many battles. When did you ever encounter an enemy who would not bleed when your aim was true?
Ja said nothing more. He knew his dreams were not those of children, but warnings given from the spirits that had always protected the people, when they were wise enough to obey the warnings, that is. After all, was that not why young men went to the Sweat Lodge, to make themselves ready for guidance from the spirit world? Ja kept his mouth shut, hoping in his heart Naiche would not regret ignoring the spirit's advice. Naiche halted his weary band for a brief rest stop in rugged foothills at the southern edge of the Dragoons. Beyond the hills lay a brutally dry desert, dotted with barrel cactus, akatia plants, and choya, with scattered stands of mesquite trees offering the only possible hiding places, from the soldiers behind them led by Mickey Free and the four strange white men.
We will have no way to defend our people if they catch us out there before we reach the shelter of the Pedregosas. Slowed by the animals and heavy packs we carry, it will take us 2 suns to enter the mountains, or perhaps 3.
We have no choice. We must cross this desolate place as quickly as we can. The women will need to run, leading the pack animals. Anyone who falls behind will be left to die. Only the strongest of our people will make it to the land called Mexico, where the Bluecoats cannot follow us.
We should wait for darkness. If the Bluecoats or the four white eyes see our death sign on the horizon, they'll know where we are. We have no defenses in this open place.
We are trained to hide from our enemies when there is no place to hide. Mickey Free is guiding the Bluecoats along our tracks, and we have no tools to remove the iron shoes from our horses. The white eyes and buckskins are also behind us. There is no time to rest. If we stay here to wait for darkness, they will be closer to us.
We could lose a fight out in the open. Our people are frightened by the four whites who killed Cuchillo's warriors, and by the soldiers coming from the north.
We have many shoot rifles and bullets. Let them come to fight with us.
We are too few, Naiche. The clever white eyes have taken too many of our number. They understand our ways, and they can read our tracks too easily. We should cross this place at night, when they cannot see our dust sign in the sky. Out there on the empty desert, we all will be killed if they find our horses' sign and the direction we travel.
Nana's experience fighting the whites gave Naiche a moment's pause, but he was certain the white-skinned killers were close, and Mickey Free would not be far behind.
The iron on these soldiers' horses gives us away. This is the reason why they find us so easily. But we must have strong horses. Without them, we are helpless. The time has come for us to prove we are Apaches, in spite of the tracks we leave for them to follow.
Darkness is not far away. I agree with Nana that we should wait, for with sundown the light is gone, and they will not see us or the hoof prints left by our animals.
Chocole offers you wise counsel, Chief Naiche. Even if they find us here, we have rocks and arroyos where we can fight them off with repeating rifles.
Naiche recalled the wisdom of Geronimo, and how many times he had told the people it was better to hide and fight an enemy at the place and time where the advantage belonged to the Apache, and not the enemy.
Geronimo avoids direct contact with our white enemies. He leads them into traps, where even a few good warriors can win battles against many times their number. If we wait here for the sun to sleep, we lose precious time. If we keep moving, we have the advantage of being far out in front of them.
Our people, especially the women, are tired and afraid of these white men. Under the cover of darkness, they will have less fear.
I am chief of the Chiricahuas! The spirits guide me. We will cross this desert now and put more distance between us and the whites while the sun warms the air. If we wait for darkness, the freezing cold will hamper our horses, and the women will not be able to travel as fast.
Nana lowered his head. Chicole looked off at the horizon where the sun would fall below the desert in a few short hours, providing the darkness she and Nana wanted.
You are our leader, Naiche. I will do whatever you say we must do to reach safety. If you tell us to go now, we will go.
Across the desert floor, Shimmering heat waves created the illusion of water in the distance. A hawk circled far to the south above the Ocotillo spines, hunting, seeking prey before the darkness ended its chances of a successful feeding on the snakes and lizards it might find in the dry land. Riding currents of hot air, it rose on wings spread far from its body, a sure sign no danger lurked beneath it.
The hawk gives us our sign. It hunts without fear. The way is clear across this desert. Tell the women to run as fast as they can with the pack animals. It is time to go.
Juh pointed to a spot in front of them.
Look beyond the Choya, Naiche. A coiled rattlesnake lies in our path. It is a sign to go in another direction, for the snake is a messenger of death.
Naiche saw the snake coiled in the shade below a flat stone. His stomach twisted. The rattlesnake was, as Juh said, often a messenger from the next life sent by their ancestors to turn the people away from certain disaster. More than anything else, even more than invoking the wrath of the spirits, Naiche feared being caught by the four unknown Apache hunters and the soldiers before more warriors joined them to use the many-shoot rifles lashed to their pack horses. What good were repeating rifles if he had no warriors to shoot them? He drew his knife, for he meant to kill the rattlesnake silently, as proof to Juh and the others that the serpent was not a bad omen foretelling some dark to come. He strode quickly down to the rock where the huge rattler lay coiled. The snake watched him with cold, lidless eyes. Naiche distracted the thick serpent with a sudden movement of his left foot, swinging it just close enough for a strike at the top of his knee-high deerskin boots. The rattler struck, deadly fangs bared. Naiche jerked his foot away just in the nick of time and sent his gleaming knife blade downward in a swift arc. The tip of the knife caught the snake behind its broad head and tore through its layers of scales as Naiche pinned it to the ground. Coiling around him, it was helpless to inject its poisonous fangs into his flesh. Naiche sliced the serpent's head off. He stuck the rattler's head on the tip of his knife, turned toward Juh and the line of Apaches waiting for him on the crest of a hill. Nods of approval went down the row of warriors and women by means of a simple demonstration proving that the rattler was not a warning from the spirits to turn away. Naiche had given his people new hope and courage. He returned to his people and mounted his bay with the snake's head displayed on his knife tip. Single file, they started downslope toward the welcome heat of the desert floor that would take them to the Pedregosas, then across the Mexican border to safety.